From Noble Robot on East Hennepin Avenue in accurate Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where nice game devs talk games and game development.
I'm Ellen Burns Johnson, and I make nice games.
I'm Steven McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Mark LaCroix. I, too, make nice games. For this week's episode, our topics are Scoring 101 and Turning Off the Game Dev Brain. And so, if everyone's ready, let's start. So, Steven, you are joining the legions of cineasts. Is that what's happening?
I'm taking a filmmaking class, yes.
Uh-huh.
Is that what cineast means?
I don't know.
Learn about that? listeners might remember that I don't talk about it a lot on the show, actually, but I feel like I should maybe more talk about it more often. I did not graduate college. I flunked out twice, so I don't have a degree yet, but I've been steadily working towards my degree the past few years. Like, I'm taking one class a semester, and I've been taking breaks here and there depending on random things that have happened.
My favorite part about this for is that you don't have to do this.
I absolutely don't, and I'm still doing it.
And you're committed, and it's never occurred to you to not do it.
Oh, it has.
Well, I have never heard you.
That's fair. You haven't heard me complain about it yet.
In their quiet moments, perhaps.
Yeah.
I really admire that.
I appreciate that.
And every semester you let us know what you're doing,
mm-hmm.
and you're building towards things that will help you in a practical way. So you're not doing it for the piece of paper.
Right.
But you're doing it, man.
Yeah,
it's cool. I like it. No one's making you.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was part of the issue, is because a lot of it was my dad was making me do it the first few times. But yeah, this is just me. So this class is filmmaking class, and I will be learning about how to make film. My intention is to learn to try to take some of these camera techniques and stuff. Like, I don't think I can do the editing stuff. Well, maybe. But mostly the camera techniques and stuff, and apply that practice to video games in some way, shape or form.
Mm-hmm.
Because I have, while I've been doing this degree, I definitely have, and that's the intention of the degree, is to help me better understand making games and what that can do. So it's just been beneficial to do that. So I'm hoping that this new class will open up new avenues and directions for me. So we'll see.
Yeah, just it's more vocabulary. Talk about all sorts of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mark is very excited.
I'm thrilled because I've had no one to talk to about this sort of thing.
Yeah.
And I haven't worked in film in a long time.
I do want to remind listeners that this is just a beginner class. But I mean, I'll know a little bit. So
I'll take any conversation partner, honestly.
It's interesting because this new class is related to the topic that I'm bringing up in the second half of the episode.
Cool.
That'll be cool.
Looking forward to that.
Mm-hmm.
Ellen, news from top of the pond. I don't know what to describe Duluth
from
here.
From up north.
Yeah. Up north, yeah.
My parents, they tested Robustin for us. And
yes.
We talked about that for a whole episode,
mm-hmm.
about how that went.
Right.
And apparently it didn't go as poorly as I thought.
Oh.
Because I got them to play another tabletop game.
Okay.
This is really good data.
Yeah. That is good, actually. That's good to know.
I mean, it wasn't Robustin that we played.
Sure.
It was a different game.
Okay.
But we had some of the same reactions. I got a game from Barnes and Noble.
Mm-hmm.
And they have a bunch of exclusive games right now. We're gonna have to dig into that because that's really interesting.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, this game is about national parks for sure. So I got it and I took it home and I put it on the table. And then my husband went away to go camping for several days with friends. So it's like me and my parents, like, we're gonna, how do you feel about playing this game? And they're like, yeah.
Okay.
So I'm like, okay. We unboxed it and everything. I had them punch out the cards and take the plastic off.
Oh, fun.
And then I read the rules. And there were some moments where this is a lot. I don't quite. And no, it's okay. It's okay. And we got through it. And by the end, they're like, that was really fun.
Cool.
That was. And my dad did that thing that you guys saw where he's like, wow.
Yes.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
And, so we talked about it over the next few days and we had a really good time with it.
Aww.
It was great theming, really great art in the box. And so they want to play it again.
That's wonderful.
Last year, so this is a game from a company called Keymaster who's put it out. They had a booth at Gen Con or Origins or one of the board game things we went to last year.
Yeah.
And I remember wanting to pitch something to them because I was like, oh, they get it. The tying together of mechanic and theme.
Yeah.
And gorgeous art and that presentation matters. And it's just like, Dogpile was not for them, no, under no circumstance.
Yeah.
But I just just chatted with them for a while, just to like, I wanted to be next to it.
Cool.
It's very cool. Like, yeah, you were just talking, it's a great looking thing. The theme is interesting. I've not played it. It's just like, it made such a good first impression. Hmm. But it's a good game, it sounds.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah, it was fun.
Cool.
And I think, you know, I mean, it always takes like twice as long to learn the game as it says it's going to play it on the box.
Right.
So, and that's fair, but we had, you know, grabbed like a cocktail and took a break for dinner. We actually played half of the game one night and then left it out on the table and picked it up the next day. And we, it's kind of a low scoring game. Like, we're talking about victory points, mm-hmm, or at least it was the first time through. And we were really close. It was like 15, 16, 17 points.
Oh,
and my mom won. So,
nice.
That was cool. Every time we turned over a new park card, we were like, oh, Grand Canyon. Oh, Big Ben, or whatever, you know. Yeah. Look at the art on this one. It was just a really good experience.
Aww, so that's wonderful.
If you want to get your nerdy nature parents hooked on tabletop games, then you should do that one.
My parents don't like playing board games. I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah. My parents will do like party games.
Yeah.
That are, you know, like a Code Names.
Sure.
Or something.
Dang, you can get them to play Code Names? I can't even get my family to play Code Names.
Play is a strong word.
Okay. That's fair.
We get through it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's honestly, Ellen, it's a blessing that you could get them to play more complicated board games like that. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You got to get them to play a new game every week, and then you can do reports here on the show.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
That sounds like a, let's take it slow.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, quick aside about national parks. I learned today that the lock and dam on the St. Anthony Falls, which is the waterfall in the Mississippi here in Minneapolis, it's the only natural falls on the whole Mississippi. The lock and dam system, so you can actually traverse past it, that's that area is a national park.
Huh.
Or at least it's managed by the National Park Service.
Oh, okay.
I just learned this today. Yeah. I don't have all the details.
Sure. Okay. That's interesting.
Yeah. Cool. There are national parks, but then there are all a bunch of other like sites that are managed by the National
Park Service. Oh, okay. Sure.
Aren't parks, like very like specific historical sites and so on and so forth. And I know this because I'd helped design some onboarding training for them like a long time ago.
Wow. Cool.
They're probably still not using it. And I don't even know if they ended up using the prototype that I made, but it was really cool to learn about that.
Yeah, that's fun.
Anyway.
That's one of the things I miss about client work is learning about other people's jobs.
Yeah.
That was fun when I was doing that a long, long time ago. Now I just have to like look on Wikipedia for that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's the best.
Yeah.
As you can imagine, and this is the last national park thing I'll share today. As you can imagine, those people love their jobs.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, love them.
That's cool.
So
that's good.
That's important. Special. Yeah.
Okay.
What's next?
Mark was introduced to the Badger Badger Mushroom song and was underwhelmed. Is on this list. That happened.
I added that. It was important.
Okay. I guess
hadn't seen Badger Badger Mushroom.
It's not that great. It's very old. I'm sure that my cousins also haven't seen it, and they would not be impressed now either. Sorry, Ellen. I don't mean to lay it out like that, but I also mean to lay it out like that. It's on the note, so.
Well, I'm okay. All right. Moving on.
I have nothing to add.
Okay. Great.
You were working on Noble Tools.
Yes.
Yes.
It says.
I was saying and then added the last topic, but I appreciate you were trying to transition diplomatically.
I was trying to end that painful.
Yeah. I've talked about this on the show before, but I'm building a suite of tools for Unity that I'm in simultaneously with building Dream Settler. And I spent a lot of time today on building out some of the features that will be important when I release this as a third-party tool set.
Yeah.
Rather than just as something I use. And it's been a lot of fun because I've been using Unity's UI Elements UI framework, which is very web dev-y, right? Mm-hmm. It has a subset of CSS called USS, which is hilarious. And a subset of, it has got a markup language that's an XML, has an XML schema called UXML.
Okay.
And it describes markup and style, and then it interacts with a C# API, which is really interesting. And you use that to build interfaces. And right now, it's really good for building interfaces within the Unity editor.
Yeah.
It was originally designed to eventually replace the Unity UI all these names are confusing and very similar, that is game object based in an actual Unity game. You can do that today, but they don't recommend it because like everything Unity makes takes about 5 or 6 years to recommend you actually use it.
Yeah.
But it's really good for editor tools. And they do recommend it for that as opposed to the old system, which never made any sense. You ever made an editor script that like displays a custom editor window? It is this weird, because it's immediate mode, it draws it as the code goes, which is not how you do anything else in Unity. And so it's just, it's not intuitive and you can figure it out, but it's not fun and you never really want to dive into it. But this new system is great. And I toyed with this for years, but never found a real reason to get into it that much. But now that I'm making these tools and I'm going to be shipping them, I thought, well, maybe I'll get a little more serious. So I came up with some like layouts and logos and like design rules for how the components work. The kinds of things you do when you're making a piece of software as opposed to a game. And I had a little bit of fun with that. I can't get too deep into it because I need to sort of split my time when I'm working on Dream Settler. I can't do all this stuff. But it's been really fun. I'm really looking forward to talking more about it. And I realize I've been teasing this for a long time on the show.
I guess that is true, huh?
But when it comes out, I think, listeners, you're going to be the first people I'm going to try to sell it to. So so get ready for that in the middle of the show.
That's cool, though. Looking forward to hearing more about that.
All right. Well, that's enough of me for the whole episode. Ellen, you've got a topic.
I do.
Is that the new topic intro music?
That's the segue music.
Oh,
yeah.
Oh, yeah, I recognized it.
You mean you couldn't tell?
I super could.
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
I'm like terrible batting average this. Okay, great. I'm glad I have a whole topic to get through. It's going to be about numbers, guys.
Look, numbers are great. So I'm on board with this.
Yeah. All right. So, well, my coworker and I, she is working. She's kind of in like she's in the like lead game designer role for the platform right now. And as the only other self-described hired as game designer in the company. I'm in a mentor position for her.
Okay.
And so we meet a couple times a week, talk about what's going on, talk through problems. Sometimes we get to do game design together. It's the best. And we did that a little bit today. So she's working on this kind of system where we have a bunch of different mini games. And these again are, I think I've mentioned this on the show before, but in this context, these are mini games that are mechanically like set, the game mechanics are set, but people can bring their own content. So like quiz games, for example, and we have a puzzle game that's a Wordle-like, it's called Noodle, but you can like make your own puzzles and it accommodates, it's got some different things in there that make it not Wordle, and also make it a useful part of the platform.
Yeah.
Like Jeopardy is a game on there, an officially licensed Jeopardy. They're working on a system that will help like string mini games together into like a big super game.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, which isn't a thing right now. So it's like
a WarioWare, if you will.
Is it? Yeah, like a WarioWare? Okay.
Yeah, it's like, you start one and then it moves you on to the next one and moves you on to the next one. There's a gamification platform that you can use to kind of do that, but it's much more complex and it's not quite the same. And so one of the challenges in doing this is if you want to make a super game, a game of games, you need to have some sort of scoring system that lets you kind of level set across the whole experience. And that's what she's working on right now. And so we got to have a lot of fun conversations today about game design, and it was about points. And that got me thinking about math. And points. And I don't feel like I do a lot of math. Whenever I'm doing game design, I end up doing a lot of math. But it doesn't feel like work math.
Sure.
It feels like fun math.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
I was with you to that last bit.
Okay.
I kind of get it. I mean, there's certain maths that I will do that are like, you know, for puzzles and stuff. And those are entertaining. But like math I do that's any more complicated than like geometry or something more. I guess it's too hard that I don't want to do. I guess it's not too hard, but I don't want to do it. So I kind of see what you're saying.
I think I just carry, and this maybe is a common experience among people who were English majors. I carry a lot of like math trauma from childhood learning, where it's
okay, that makes sense.
Remember back to math class in fifth grade where we had timed quizzes, and I would freeze, and I would panic, and I was scared. And also, like, the teacher would, like, mispronounce my name and then get mad when I wasn't giving the answer. And it's just, like, all these bad, bad associations with math.
I see.
A math class was the first time I ever got an F.
Oh.
Like.
Okay.
I can't
imagine a world where anyone gave you an F for anything.
Yeah.
Learning things.
We're in. You don't have to imagine. Yeah. we're in that one.
Okay.
There was a lot of other stuff going on, but like, class was too hard for me. And sure. I didn't have the skills, like the personal and study skills to keep up.
Well, it also sounds like you didn't get the support that you needed in order for it to get you through it.
Well, the F was in high school.
Many sure. years
after the teacher who we referred to her as the Trunchbull. She okay. wasn't a favorite.
Uh-huh.
But no, the high school teacher was fantastic. He was very supportive.
Okay.
But it's just like there was a bunch of other stuff going on.
Sure.
And so whenever I'm like, okay, this is a fun problem and I'm going to solve it with a math puzzle. That's kind of the mindset I'm in when I'm like, okay, let's solve this game design problem that was going to require math.
Got it.
And I've started to having more of those challenges in my life has started to change my feelings about math. And so okay. like sometimes I'll like listen to a podcast that talks about zero for an hour.
Mm-hmm.
And 17-year-old me wouldn't recognize this person.
Yeah.
But what I wanted to talk about today, just to kind of like, for all you mathematics traumatized individuals out there, I want to talk about stuff, some math that you can do that involves games and you can feel good about it. And you don't have to do it for a test. This is just a time where you get to listen to some math stuff, mm-hmm. be a nerd about mm-hmm. math, and it's going to be fine.
Yes.
Big if true.
Yeah.
Okay. So what I was thinking was like, all right, so we talked with some of the things that my coworker and I were talking about was like, okay, you know, how do we score different answers? If it's an answer, like a quiz kind of based question versus like a puzzle. And it got me thinking like, okay, there's got to be some really common paradigms around how we think about points and the mathematics around points across a whole bunch of different game types and styles in different genres and different media, like media. You know, I was an English major, so that was embarrassing. I just spent the last 10 minutes talking about that. But anyway, so I wanted to do a little bit of research on that and figure out, okay, like what if you want to experiment with point systems of this type, what are some of the math things that you're going to want to like poke around with? What are the things you're going to have to do if you want to do this kind of scoring system in your game? And reversely, if you see this kind of scoring system in your game, then you can learn more about it and understand it on a deeper level if you're willing to engage with this type of mathematics.
Got it.
So the first thing I want to talk about was like points as how you earn a thing, like victory points. And that's like victory points is a very tabletop oriented term, I think. Mm. But like, you know, there are lots of games that are digital games where you like go out and you earn points. You acquire things.
Mm-hmm.
There's points as progress, like experience points. Maybe at a fundamental level, those aren't particularly different, but I think that they maybe are for today's conversation. There is at least in my research, this was called a statistics-based scoring system. It's like combinatorial. So like if you have, you know, lots of averages behind the scenes and then you have an overall score that a rating or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also looked at like health hit points as a point system. And then kind of did a little bit of research about what type of mathematics are typically used in figuring out these types of scoring systems in different games.
Hmm.
I'm not sure if I'm doing a good job of framing this, but I feel like I will carry it with my enthusiasm.
No, I honestly, I'm appreciating thinking of it in this different perspective because we do use the term points to represent several different things in ways mm-hmm. that can be confusing, but I think people understand intuitively when they play enough games.
Yeah.
So it's kind of helpful to have them framed out in this way because it's definitely something I didn't even recognize. Like, certainly you have like a victory or a scoring counter, like victory points, how well you're doing. But you also have health points, which is ultimately a lot of these points just kind of tell you how well you're doing in different avenues. So I think mm-hmm. I'm understanding what you're saying, mm-hmm. the perspective you're coming from.
Yeah. Well,
I tend to think of these things as like metaphors for other things in the game.
Yeah.
But when you describe them as like, well, these are the mathematical systems to derive them. It's easy to think of that as more of an afterthought to like the core design elements.
Yeah.
And so I think this is an interesting lens for that because you're going to do it. mm-hmm. you might as well actually do it in a considered way.
Yeah.
Is that right? Is that accurate?
Well, I mean, it's another like layer of appreciation that I don't think that doesn't often get carved out on its own, right? Yeah. Like we talk about the art behind the game, we talk about the programming behind the game, we talk about the writing behind the game, but like there is mathematics in lots of games.
Yes.
and especially in the design process. And so I wanted to just look at this one layer a little bit around this specific thing. We're not going to be talking about the mathematics involving physics. Because I can't. Because I got an F, you guys. Of course I'm not going to talk about it. surprise, I wasn't really good in physics class either. I pulled the chemical shower once and my teacher got mad.
Oh, no.
Yeah. I think she kept me in that class because it was entertaining. Anyway, yes, this is all math. I feel like I could probably do and maybe do with some help. Mm. Okay. So mathematics often involved with scoring. We talk about victory points. I mean, fundamentally, it's mostly simple addition and or subtraction, right? Like you do a thing, you get a point. You do this thing, you get 4 points. You get this harder thing, you get a few more points than if you did this easier thing. So that's pretty straightforward. The game that I play with my parents was all about that. Like, again, small number of points at the end. That might be because we were new to the game, but even if we were, you know, I can't imagine you're getting like 80 victory points in that game. You're getting like 20.
Sure.
Maybe 30 would be like crazy. Mm-hmm. And it's just incremental, right? You're just getting it a couple points at a time. Really easy to keep in your head for the, you know, for the player. The balancing thing would maybe be interesting, but you're not dealing with like a huge set of variables. I mean, you are, but like it's not as big as you might encounter in like a JRPG or something. So you sometimes have multiplication, like bonus points or multipliers. So you're going to deal with multiplication also. So it's right in there. Like, okay, if you have this card, when you visit this park, you're going to get, you know, 3 extra victory points, or you're going to double the victory points or something that you can get. So that's a really common thing. And then, you got to do like algebra for like calculating final scores. I think a lot of the times, at least with the games that are in my head right now that I've played most recently, and you don't have to do algebra to calculate your final score. You just have to do more addition. You have to be able to recognize which conditions are met and not met. And that's it.
Yeah.
I feel like the victory point kind of system is very mathematically simple.
Sure.
Probably why it's used a lot.
Well, and it also makes sense because like players, that's their victory condition, right? They need to get the most to win, or they need to get a certain point. And so that's the thing that they need to be calculating and recalculating over and over again. So it makes sense that that mathematics is simple for them, for people, because they can keep doing it over and over. If it was more complicated, they wouldn't be able to parse when they were winning or losing and then make it more difficult to play.
Yeah. Mark is processing.
Well, you're exactly right. Like there's the simplicity of it is not about keeping it in your head now.
Yeah.
It's about keeping it in your head, holding it in your head for a long time.
Yes.
And so that becomes a requirement of the design, unless you're trying to tax the player on that dimension.
Yeah.
And especially for board games, that's generally not part of the design.
Yeah.
It's meant to be as intuitive as possible because your game is not about keeping track of numbers. The numbers are what keep track of other things.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But then it means that you might have a better balance system with a more complicated mathematics or you know, calculation system. And some games do that. But then those games are less approachable.
Yeah.
And you have to kind of make some, you know, everything's everything.
Yeah.
You know, I'm glad you mentioned that, like a more balanced system, because it occurs to me, I was like, okay, and then basic algebra, I guess you don't really need that. But you actually kind of do it, not at the end of the game, you know, when you finished gameplay, but during gameplay, your goal is to acquire those victory points, whatever form they might take.
Right.
And usually you have to exchange a bunch of different things in different orders to get those victory points. And you might be taking a different strategy to exchange different things than the player on your right, because there's a limited number of resources, right? There are only so many parks that you visit that will give you the mountain icon or the mountain token.
Yeah.
So you're not going to go for mountain tokens. You're going to go for water tokens. And your mom's going to beat you anyway. And it's totally fine. You're over it. but that does require algebra and ratios and some mathematics.
Yes, sure.
But to your guys' point, like it's not at a level that requires calculation. It's usually pretty intuitive.
Yeah.
At the amount of complexity that you're dealing with.
Right, right.
In any given moment. So that's victory points. Mm-hmm. And now I want to talk about experience points, which I always found really interesting because it's just like an example of this phenomenon to me of just like line go up.
Yeah.
There's just something pleasing about bigger.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It doesn't have to mean anything. It's just bigger.
Mm.
You just like seeing it bigger. And yeah, the stuff will cost more, I guess, sometimes. Like, it, you know, like I'm just thinking back to World of Warcraft, which is where I've probably spent the most amount of time leveling up. Mm. But you'll see this in a whole bunch of RPGs, right? Like the deeper into the game, the higher level you are, the longer it takes to get to the next milestone.
Right.
Right. But everything else is also more powerful. I mean, you see this, you see the natural conclusion of this thinking in free-to-play games, where you end up with like point totals in the billions and quadrillions and made up units even higher than that to sort of keep the experience similar, but feeling bigger because it's less mathematics and more psychology.
Right? Yeah.
The math doesn't even change that much with the scale. Now, things can change.
Right.
But a big part of that number go up is about theming and feeling.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is, you know, we have been critical of on this show in the past, but is a real thing that is really important.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I think one of my favorite examples of a line go up game is a game called Eggs Inc., which is a little free to play game, which is you get a lot of eggs from a lot of chickens, and it's just lots, right? Like that's the theme of this game. And they just leaned into it, so you have like dozens of chickens, and they're running from here to there, and then you have even more chickens, and then you have even more chickens, and then your chickens lay different kinds of eggs, and the eggs get crazier and crazier.
Yeah.
You just line go up.
Line go up.
But in order to have a progression curve that captures players early and teaches them how to do it at a low risk like level, and then keeps you going until you're like at the end.
The end, she says.
Yeah, yeah. So that is going to require some things, right?
Yeah.
So yes, you have addition and subtraction for gaining and losing XP, but in the milestones you layer on top of your XP, you need to be looking at more complex algebraic formulas, or you know, maybe some exponential or logarithmic functions to figure out how you want that curve to feel.
Right.
Yeah.
And how you scale everything else to work with that, multipliers all around you,
mm-hmm.
which you can then use to guide the player experience. Like number go up here, but then once you reach this level, number don't go up as much. So, but if you go this way, which didn't seem as attractive to you before, that's where the number go up. And so you can guide an experience based on that. And you need to communicate to the player how that will work in a kind of secret hidden language sense.
But I do appreciate that you bring up that it's, you know, a logarithmic or exponential curve. The curve is difficult to grasp at a glance. It could, because a lot of that stuff does not need to necessarily be portrayed to the player. The player just needs to know, this thing gives me more XP and I need more XP, so I should go in this direction, right?
Yeah, even if you're just talking about like classic D&D,
like
10 experience points is a lot when you have no experience points.
Yes.
But when you have 2,000 experience points,
mm-hmm.
who cares? Why bother?
Right, right.
Right? So it just changes a lot.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. That's interesting. It changes the context, which is cool.
This is kind of one of these, there's just like this synergy, and sometimes you come across these things that just are cool. I'm not really sure if there's anything more to it, but Kurt Vonnegut's famous failed master's thesis, The Shape of Stories, always makes me think, like I always think about that when I think about this kind of scaling, because it is the shape of the story, right? Like, so, you know, I'm playing Flappy Dragon and I've got 259 of the 260 dragons at this point.
Yeah.
And the amount of effort I have to get to find that last dragon is so, I have to keep playing for so long to get that one egg that I'm missing. Like, it's the shape of the story. And, you know, I don't think Mr. Vonnegut had logarithmic in one of his shapes.
Yeah.
But it is kind of funny because I feel like he should have. If you play more games, maybe.
I mean,
burn on Kurt Vonnegut.
Not a burn. Well, you know, if Eggs Inc. were around when he was writing that failed master's thesis, maybe he would have added it. And maybe the master's thesis committee would have been like, oh, now I get it. Okay, so a couple more things. So statistics-based scoring, this is the one I feel like I just don't have the most grasp on, but like,
okay,
this is where you're looking at combining multiple stat values. So to give, you know, something, some other higher level value that you need to track for some reason. And I think this came up mostly in like player rankings, which I don't care about.
Yeah.
It's just so, but maybe I'm missing something. So please come to the Discord and tell me what I'm missing when it comes to stats-based scoring of some sort. But at least they're talking about like weighted averages. We're talking about ways that certain level one statistics get prioritized or get prioritized in the calculations of the level two statistical value, which is interesting to me. I can't think of anything right now, but that's probably because I'm just not coming at the memory buffers from the right angle or with the right query. Cause there's probably some stuff out there like in titles that we'd recognize where this is a factor. I just don't know. And that's more statistical, advanced statistical concepts. Guess who didn't do well with statistics? This one. So like standard deviation for player rankings, that might be interested. I get the concept of standard deviation. Don't make me do one, but like, I get it. So that is interesting. This one, I feel like I want to come back to at some point because the fact that I can't think of any game systems that use this that aren't sports related bothers me. There's gotta be something.
Well, I think that's part of why it's the use case for it is because like it's much more focused on competitive nature things.
Yeah. There's a game I play, a daily game called Puzzmo, which is a website with crosswords and various puzzles in it. You can play as many of them as you want. It's kind of like a newspaper puzzle page.
Yeah.
It has collective stats. You get points for each of the games, and you can compete in the stats of a daily score across them all or just in an individual game. Uh-huh. And the creators of that game have talked in the Discord about just the challenge of making that not only just literally work, but actually just make sense to people.
Yeah.
When you're like, how do you, if someone's really into the crossword and somebody is really into a game called Spell Tower, but not into the crossword, how do you make those players have a similar experience when it comes to this meta component?
Yeah.
It's very statistics based. And one of the things that's really interesting is that with so many players, they show score distributions on a histogram. Which is really interesting as a way for you to understand like how well you did compared to other people, but also how many other people did as well as you in that little bracket, which is nice because some games are really easy and everybody does really well. And so you will find, and then some games are just really hard and it's a much more even distribution of scores. And so that visual element helps you understand if you're interested in that. And what I find fascinating is I am not at all as a player interested in that. Sure. As a developer, it's very fascinating.
Yeah. You know?
Because it presents a challenge about like not just how the numbers present and how they add up, but literally what do they mean?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. It doesn't surprise me that you find that interesting because like you made a game about that and it was called Metro. It's called Metro Nexus.
Yeah, fair. It shouldn't surprise anyone.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah.
You know, but I'm really glad you brought that up though, because it brings a layer to this conversation that I hadn't really considered, which is like sometimes it's just points, but the way you frame the points or visualize the points in context of other data is the thing that makes it interesting.
Yes.
So I'm going to have to talk to Lydia, my coworker, about this next week. I'm like, we did an episode on scoring and we talked about some things and I want you to listen to it. But it's not out yet. So you get a sneak preview. Anyway.
That's
really Ellen's just doing work research here on the show.
I mean,
it's a good use of your time.
Yeah, we all do that. It's not
that's
just Ellen.
That's the whole show. Mark, that's the show.
We just get benefits from it, I guess. This does remind me, this method of scoring, the way that you like change the way that your score is counted for, and it kind of changes how you view the game, reminds me of this episode of Summoning Salt that me and my brother watched recently. That was interesting, but also frustrating in a lot of ways because it was like about people speed running Mario Kart DS. Mm-hmm. And the way that those were scored was based on how your ranking on each individual course like added together, and they did some math. I don't remember what the math was, otherwise I'd say but it like changed the metagame of how people were approaching the speed running in a way that was kind of frustrating because I just want to see people go faster. But like this was more like they had to be more strategic And like they, some people would be like, man, I can't stand running Rainbow Road. I'm just not going to do it. And their scores would suffer as a result. Whereas other people were more generalized and good at all of the different courses. And so they'd have different scores based off of that.
Speedrunning is an interesting angle for this.
Yeah.
In a lot of ways, the one I'm thinking of is like in Super Mario Brothers.
Yeah.
It has what's called the frame rule where it only ever
imagine a bus.
Yeah. I'm not going to, you've all heard it. And if you haven't, go online and then you can join the club of having heard of it.
Yes.
But basically what it means is that, world records, have lots of variability in them because it's not just about raw score, raw time.
Right.
There's actually wiggle room and how you spend that wiggle room is important.
Yeah.
And there's also a matter of scoring where if you get a good score, you get the fireworks. And so you try to avoid that, but you're still trying. When you actually have to go slower in order to pick up speed later.
Yep.
And all of that is just about managing things that are essentially score kept.
Yes.
Even if it's not all of it is score, right? Because time is another score.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
It's, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Last thing.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Want to talk about HPs.
Okay. The healths.
So the healths. So it was interesting because when I just researched scoring, we're going to call it the healths now.
Okay.
What? We
regret to
us.
Inform you.
I'm sorry. I guess.
No, I don't think I can. I don't think I can sustain that.
All right.
It's just such a hard word to say. Helps.
Yeah, it is.
It's got too many consonants in a row.
That was part of the gag, I think. Anyways.
So about them.
Yeah.
Strike three. I guess I'm done. So hit points.
Yeah.
Right. Was interesting to me is that as I was researching, the results and information I got back when I asked just about points and scoring systems was slightly different when I modulated my search and I was like, okay, hit points as scores. I got different input back. But a lot of the fundamental math I think is the same. But one of the interesting things that was kind of like not mentioned in the other types of scoring systems that was mentioned when it comes to hit points is the idea of thresholds.
Okay.
And I feel like, you know, we can combine that concept with some of the other things that we talked about. Like what would the word be? Like for status effects of different sorts or like different other things that happen is like, there's a threshold. You drop to 75, drop the boss to 75% of their HP, and then they change their mode of attack or something like that. Mm. You know, like, and you can, when a boss happens that way, oftentimes from phase to phase, you're changing the feeling a ton.
Yeah, right.
And so it might be, you almost think of them as like different curves, different story shapes in the different phases, which means you'll have to change the mathematics a little bit around how your damage gets done.
Yeah.
So like, you know, if you have to switch from your huge, big two-hander mega DPS weapon from phase one into something more ranged in phase two, and you're like plinking away, that's going to change the feeling of progression a lot. And you're going to have to account for that in the mathematics, which, you know, I thought was really interesting.
Yeah.
And that was my TED talk. Thank you.
I do think that there's something interesting about health. If you think of them in terms of points, health, it typically you're subtracting from health, right? And I think that changes the context because you're subtracting from it, it kind of details how poorly you're doing versus how victory points tell you how well you're doing. I think that's kind of an interesting framing mechanism between these different forms of points.
Yeah, people will take greater risks in search of points.
Mm-hmm.
They'll take a greater risk to not get those points.
Yeah.
Versus they'll be more have more loss aversion in taking risks that might lose them some health.
Yes.
And part of that is just what those things mean, a game over or whatever. But a lot of it is just the number, and that is going up or down.
Mm-hmm.
Even if you're not at risk of losing all your points or your hit points or, you know, whatever. Like if you're just going to be in the middle the whole time and you don't have any like larger consequences, you will still have more loss aversion if number go down.
Yeah.
Then opportunity cost of number not go up.
Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now you're getting into the behavioral economics of the thing.
Yeah.
Which, we're not going to get into that.
Yeah, maybe that's for another time.
Probably. I think the last thing I want to share, just to kind of tie a bow on it.
Yep.
Whatever.
Pick any two of those. We're good.
bow tie.
Uh-huh.
All right.
It's just because like there's all those calculations happening on the fly.
Yeah.
And especially with video games, like the players don't see it.
Yeah.
Right.
They just feel it. Mm-hmm. It's just intuitive. It just happens. And I think that's pretty magical.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I mean, yeah, that's, I think that's a lot of the context here is that, like, those different, you as the developer get to make all those tweaks and changes. And depending on what kind of scoring, how your points work, you can tweak those more effectively or less effectively at the expense of potentially the player understanding what it is you're actually doing, like the really specifics of it.
Yeah.
You being able to make those tweaks can be very valuable if that is something that your game needs. But it's helpful to recognize when it's important for points to be very player facing and clear, like when the player is earning 5 points and why they're earning 5 points, versus being able to tweak it so that the player earns 501 points here versus the 499 points in this other section or something.
Yeah. Do you engage with the player's decision making tree?
Yeah.
Or is it really just about evolving the status of what's going on?
Yeah.
The world in which they make other decisions.
Yeah.
And there's not really a right answer all the time for each type of thing, but there are a common language for a lot of it.
Yeah. And I think we hit a lot of those, like the specifics of it in this topic.
We have a Discord. We've mentioned it many times. What I'd like to mention today is some really cool stuff that's happening. It happened on the Discord this week. We were talking about the Apply Your Context Thusly episode in the chat, and this conversation kind of unfolded over the next couple of days, and Joe jumped in and Lane jumped in, and I asked him, you know, asked the group how they think about onboarding players differently in different types of media, and August jumped in and made a good joke, and Lane jumped in and made a cool comment, and then we kind of went back and forth, and it was a really good conversation that kind of extended what we had been talking about in the episode with some really cool stuff. Like this one phrase that Lane put out: in mobile, users are often installing to pass a little time. They often have zero financial time or social reason to stick around, so their tolerance for friction or confusion is lower than in tabletop, which I thought was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And I really like the way that he said that. So I would like to invite you, if you haven't already joined, to come to the Discord server and share your own thoughts about stuff that goes on there and the stuff that we talk about on the show, because you have a unique perspective and it will be valuable to the other people in the community.
Yeah, I mean, we did like 3 episodes talking about teaching Robustin.
Yes.
Like in a row.
Yeah.
And then the Discord gives a whole new dimension to it that like makes the topic bigger and more interesting.
Right.
Just by comparing it to other things. It's incredible what happens when more people are in the clubhouse.
You can join us at nicegames.club/discord.
Shopify is a global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. And sell more with less effort thanks to the Shopify magic, your AI-powered all-star. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/redcircle, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/redcircle now to grow your business no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/redcircle.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Think of a song you really love.
Don't you want to know why you love it so much?
Well, we can't answer that.
No, but we can deep dive into it anyway.
Unless we get too sidetracked.
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast.
One musician.
And one psychologist.
Talking about iconic songs. The musical tricks that blow our minds.
And what they show us about our minds.
Join us each week as we pick apart everything from TLC to Weezer.
And from Billie Eilish to Bruno Mars, with plenty of distractions in between.
Check out Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.
Okay, so I brought up at the beginning of this episode that I literally just started this class. I've taken one class so far of filmmaking. But I'm already worried that it's going to change how I view movies for the rest of my life. In a way that I think working on games has changed how I view games constantly now.
I can just imagine the scene, interior, classroom, dim lights flicker on the screen, medium shot panning in on a student in the third row, and suddenly his eyes wide, and he whispers to himself, I've made a huge mistake.
You know what sucks is I understood like a quarter of those terms. I hate learning. Anyways. No. So this made me think about and the fact that like I can't really turn off game dev brain when I'm like playing a video game. I think part of that is just I have a lot of empathy for developers when they do a thing and there's a bug and I'm like, this is annoying. But I'm also like, dang, I've had to deal with this too. But I also think of it with respect to specifically for this topic, I'm thinking of it with respect to like game design. I'll oftentimes like play a game and be like, why did they make this decision? Partly because I'm like, why would they make this decision? This sucks. But I'm also like, they had to have had a reason.
Lots of empathy, right?
Yeah. Right. I don't tell them these things.
That's the empathy.
Yeah. Right. But they've had to have had a reason for why they made these decisions a certain way, right? And so like it's difficult for me to play a game now and just like ignore that instinct, that thought about how they made these decisions, why they decided to do the things that they did. Where it's different for me when I'm watching TV or I'm watching a movie, because I don't understand those. I will understand the technical parts of movies, but I don't understand them currently, right? So it's easy for me to just be like, oh, this is a thing. And there's a story happening and it's fun, explosions, things like that. But I know, like, when we do watch, like, when you and me, Mark, watch movies and things together, you will bring up, like, this was a weird framing or something like that.
Yeah, it'll be really annoying, I think.
And I mean, in the moment, I'm like, sure, I guess, because like I don't have enough context to understand that.
Uh-huh.
But I will. I'll have a better understanding of that soon. So I guess I just wanted to talk about this idea and how both of you experience it. Do you feel like when you're playing a video game, do you have a hard time not acknowledging the game design behind the game? And also, is it like important? That is it a valuable thing that like this brings to the game? Does it like enhance your experience actually? Because I think it enhances my experience in some respects, but other times it is a detriment because I'm thinking about that and not thinking about the game that I'm playing. So I'm just curious y'all's experience with it.
I'll go first.
Okay.
I guess I'm just not worried about it.
Okay.
I think the argument is I've only got so much space in my brain, so much real estate for the thought.
Sure.
And I should really be just devoting it to the experience of playing the game.
Yeah.
Because thinking about like, oh, how did they do that? Or, oh, I noticed that. Or, oh, I recognize that technique. Or, oh, I'm impressed by that technique.
Yeah.
That takes you out of it, right? And also it takes up that real estate.
Yeah.
I guess I'm of the opinion that there's plenty of real estate.
Sure.
I think.
Okay.
I'm sort of taking that on faith because I don't know any other thing. But I did play a lot of video games before I started making them.
Yeah.
And I also just can't, I don't know, it just seems... It seems sad to not know or be interested in those things. And I guess I just can't prove it, but I feel like I'm still able to set that part aside, compartmentalize it, and still experience it. And that empathy that you're talking about, of why they made choices the way they did, it also lets you take in what their intentions as you interpret them anyway, and you may not get it right. Be able to take those in a more earnest and honest way. Which I would argue, I wouldn't argue strongly.
Okay.
I would argue strongly that it's great to have that space taken up by all that meta stuff. That's fantastic.
Yeah.
But I would slightly less strongly, but still a bit, that you can have a greater appreciation with that extra context. You have to devote a lot of energy to have all those thoughts.
Yeah.
And so maybe that's the only downside. But I don't know. I don't see that as it... in any way a downside or a compromise or, oh, I can't see it anymore. But I don't know. I don't know. It'd be hard for me if someone made a real strong case why they felt the opposite. I couldn't tell them they're wrong.
Sure.
But I feel very strongly that, at least from my experience, I don't have that kind of negative impact.
Okay.
Or worry even.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And I definitely see where you're coming from because I definitely feel like it, in a lot of cases, does help me appreciate the work that goes into a lot of media in general. But also just the decisions that they made, like you were saying. Mm-hmm. I think that's important and valuable. And when you're an outsider looking in, you don't have that information, it's kind of difficult to, even if you can personally recognize that this thing takes a lot of work, it's difficult to actively know how much work it actually takes and appreciate it from that angle. Ellen, how do you feel about the game dev brain?
You know, I feel pretty similar to Mark.
Okay.
In that I don't worry about it.
Okay.
I am aware when I have studied and practiced within like an art form or a discipline a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I definitely am aware that I am aware of more things.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
Like music, for example, I've studied music a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a professional musician, not by a long shot, but I'm a very experienced lay musician, hobbyist, I guess.
Sure, yeah.
I know when something like, oh, that is flat. Or I know where that, you know, I recognize like phrases that come from different commonly referenced themes, so on and so forth. Like, okay, well, this was based on the theme from Swan Lake, or that was a jazz lick that, you know, Eric taught me about from improv, you know, gone or not, gone but not forgotten, da da da, you know, that kind of thing. And I recognize myself that I am recognizing those things.
Yeah.
Okay. And I appreciate that experience.
Yeah.
And same, if I come across something that is like, if it hits me right, I forget all of it and I'm just there.
Sure. Yeah.
So it's the same thing with like watching a show or watching, you know, a movie or something like that. If it's a good movie, it's just like doesn't really quite hit the right notes for me. I can't necessarily get into that state. Although with movies and books, it's a lot easier for me to just get into it. Like I will go read all of the lore about something and then go watch the movie and enjoy it as much as I would have if I hadn't read it. Like,
yeah.
Spoilers it doesn't even matter. Like I'm mm-hmm. in it once it's playing, I'm having a good time and I'm just kind of there. With games, I find myself being a little bit more like what you described, Stephen.
Mm.
With the game dev brain, but only in games where I've played a lot of games within that genre.
Oh, sure. Okay. Oh.
Yeah. If I'm seeking out novel mechanics and really novel stuff or if I'm really mixing it up a lot, so I haven't played a visual novel in 8 to 12 to 14 months and I pick it up again, then that part of my brain doesn't engage until I'm done with a session and I walk away and I'm thinking about it.
Huh. That's interesting because I feel like I have the opposite experience. I feel like the more I understand, the more I've played a genre of game, the less I'm thinking about the design. Because I'm like more, I think, because I'm thinking, I'm curious about that genre and I feel less experienced in it. So I'm like, why? I have more questions, I guess. And so it makes me think about it
you
more.
You were able to compartmentalize it now.
Yeah. Right?
And you're able to experience it kind of I think what I was talking about you are experiencing that,
yeah,
but it sounds like it does take a lot of exposure for you to be able to separate those things,
which
is probably true of all of us.
Is it? I wonder if it isn't that, or if it's just like you've thought about it enough, you've solved the puzzle of it and you're ready to just play.
I
think that's kind of what it is. It's like I get it, so I don't need to think about it more from a design perspective.
I didn't expect their answers to be so different from one another.
Like, yeah, it's fascinating, so interesting. Right? Yeah.
I want to prompt the two of you because this is something where I think it might even further split us up.
Okay.
In terms of how we experience, which is really always fascinating when it happens on the show.
Yeah.
Or we might feel very similar.
Mm.
But how do you feel about knowing how a magic trick is done?
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Oh, interesting.
Is it more interesting? Is it interesting in a different way? Or is it now no longer interesting?
That's a good question. I definitely appreciate magic tricks more. Well, I don't know that I appreciate them more, but I know that I appreciate them differently when I know how they're done.
Yeah.
But I guess it's kind of like wrestling in that, like, once you understand wrestling is fake and it's just kind of a narrative, you can appreciate it from that angle instead of just like
what.
So I think it just like changes the context in which I'm appreciating a magic trick.
Does that mean that you lose what was interesting about it?
No, because I think when I see a magic trick, I know enough about magic tricks to know it's not real magic.
Oh, yeah.
Doing an illusion. So if I don't understand how they do it, then I'm like, how did they do it? Mm-hmm. When I get that answer, I'm like, wow, it's impressive that they did it that way. Mm-hmm. So I feels like it feels like step two of my enjoyment factor for Magic. Mm-hmm. I think it's kind of how I'm approaching it. I don't go to a lot of Magic shows, but like I think that's kind of I think that's how I would have approached it in the past.
Ellen?
Same.
Yeah?
Same. Okay.
Yeah. No, it's like ditto.
Yeah. All right.
Honestly.
Cool.
Yeah. Like it's cool to watch somebody do it. And it's really like, I will try to puzzle out how they did it. And I fail all the time.
Yeah.
And only rarely do I get the, you know, kind of the gratification or of being, having the trick like revealed in some way.
Sure.
Cause that's like the not typically what magicians do.
Yeah.
But that is, it's also an interesting and like joyful and gratifying experience to learn how it's done. It's just, right. It's just a different, it's like mm-hmm. a different sensation.
Yeah. Actually, I appreciate that you asked this question because it's putting in perspective what I feel like I might, what I don't think I will actually be losing, but I feel like I'm worried about losing if I start understanding how movies work is because like, I think when I watch movies, I don't think about the technical aspects of things and I'm comfortable with that idea. Like if I was to watch a magic show and I'm like, I don't know, you want to believe magic exists. Even though you don't believe magic exists, you want to believe it. Yeah. In this instance, you'll like go to a magic show and you'll be amazed that by the illusion and that'll be enough for you. You'll feel satisfied because for a brief moment, it'll feel like magic exists. Mm-hmm. I think that's kind of what I'm experiencing with movies right now. Mm-hmm. And so like having an understanding of how movies actually work will change it in a way that I don't know that I'm ready for.
Okay, that's a perfect transition to my thoughts on this.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
Because I wanted to hear the two of you first.
Yes.
Because on every dimension, mm-hmm. there is no such thing as magic.
Sure.
Like,
yeah.
Like in any way you describe it.
Yes.
Right? Like when you say it's fun to believe in magic for a while, I mean, one, I'm not interested in that. But yeah. I also don't think that is what people do when they see a magic show.
Yeah.
They're like, no one is fooled.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? And they also don't turn off their brain to pretend that it's real. Mm-hmm. There is something more complicated than that that is interesting, which is the quote-unquote magic is that it's incredible that person did it in a way that I cannot see or figure out.
Yeah.
That's the quote-unquote magic that I think people are really interested in.
Yeah.
And I don't think anybody is actually sort of role-playing a person who believes in like literal magic.
Sure. Okay.
But even in that sense, mm-hmm. there is no such thing as magic.
Okay.
And so because in a magic trick, what is the only thing that's interesting about it, if you take away the patter and the performance, which are other disciplines, mm-hmm. just the magic trick, the only thing that's interesting is how it's done.
Yeah.
And not knowing it is an interesting feeling because you want to know how it's done.
Right.
Learning how it's done does not, it is, all it is makes it more interesting. Mm. And this is my view, obviously.
Sure, yeah.
But, and so why I think this is a good transition to what you're worried about with film is that with film, there are so many more interesting things that when you understand, oh, I see, they put a dolly track and they split that wall in half so they can move the camera through the window.
Yeah.
Like, even though it looked really impressive when they did it. Like, fine. Knowing that just lets you be more excited about that, but there is no such thing as magic, so you cannot be disillusioned.
Sure.
Right? Because there's no such thing as illusion, right? In at least in the way I'm describing it.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I think that's exciting. I think that all you can be is more interested.
I just wanted to share an experience I had that I shared with Mark a few weeks ago, and that was I watched the first season of House of the Dragon and have not cared to go back.
Okay.
But what I have picked up is the behind the scenes.
Yes, you told me about this. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And I have been watching episode by episode. And they do one behind the scenes episode for that series for every episode in the main series and how it's made kind of thing.
Yeah.
So I'm watching stuff for a show that I'm watching the behind the scenes behind the scenes of a show that I'm not watching.
Yeah. That's how fascinating craft is, right?
It is. And I will say this, like, Mark, you said that there's no such thing as magic, and that is true in like the objective sense. But to watch a huge number of people come together and work with such a high degree of coordination on something that's totally wild and it literally just comes from someone's head, like that is magical. And that's what you're going to learn about. And that's pretty cool.
Well, that makes me feel good about learning again. Yeah. So that's great.
And I think one of the reasons we think about games as we worry about that as game developers a lot.
Yeah.
This is not an uncommon fear.
Yeah.
Is because there isn't a huge, frankly, commercial industry of behind the scenes material.
True.
It is when a documentary on a video game comes out that's very detailed or really explains things, people race to it because it's rare.
Mm-hmm.
And people worry about the losing the magic.
Yeah.
But the magic that Ellen is describing, which I would describe as quality.
Sure.
Right? I'm being very anal about...
Yeah.
Just so I can continue to say there's no such thing as magic.
Yeah, okay.
But Ellen has a very accurate framing that that is magical.
Yeah.
Right? I think that because video games don't have that tradition of DVD commentaries or, like really behind the scenes explanations, gamers generally don't know what we know. But people who are into film know a lot about film.
That's true.
The only reason they can't make one is because they don't have the experience or the skills.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that they don't have the knowledge.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Yeah, okay. Huh. Dang, that really puts things into perspective. I appreciate it. I'm glad I brought this practice to the clubhouse because it's definitely changed my viewing on it.
Well, I like that we all do have very different approaches.
Yeah.
But they don't contradict each other.
No, absolutely not. Yeah.
No.
Yeah, that's really good. Listeners, let us know what you think about this topic because I'm really curious because you're all game devs. I'm telling you now, you're a game dev. I'm curious what's changed about games for you after making games.
Yeah.
We'd love to hear your thoughts.
I would like to hear from someone who, if you're out there, someone who is really stymied by the fact that they're, because that's not any of us exactly, even though we've had fears and thoughts about that, you know, how much work it takes to do that. Yeah. I would like to hear from someone whose opinion is even more different than ours.
Mm-hmm.
There's a really cool book that's not related to anything that we just talked about except for with this one quote.
Okay. Yeah.
And I know this quote by heart. This book is called Moonwalking with Einstein.
Mm-hmm.
And it is called that because it is a book about memory competitions and the techniques that memory champions use to like memorize 1,000 digits of pi and that's probably like rookie numbers, but like, or like here's 5 decks of cards mixed together and repeat back the order exactly. And this goes into the techniques used by those folks to remember that. And one of the exercises in the book they actually had the reader do was try to memorize a line.
Yeah.
And the line that I wanted to memorize was, "The mind is like a spider web that catches information. The more it eats, the bigger it gets. The bigger it gets, the more it grows." And I think that's kind of related to like appreciating things.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah,
it is.
It'll give you new layers to your appreciation.
Yeah. Appreciate that. I appreciate you saying that because that's definitely what I'm coming away from this episode.
That's our show. For show notes and links on today's topics, go to our website, nicegames.club. Visit us on Threads at Night's Game Club, where Dale posts about game dev resources and cutting grass. I haven't seen this, but I'm sure it makes sense. Reply on Threads directly, or you can email us, contact@nicegames.club. Nice Games Club is on Patreon. Support the show and get stuff, including ad-free episodes. Sign up at patreon.com/nicegamesclub. And if you want to keep things more casual or have thoughts on anything we talked about today or in any previous episode or anything at all, just stop by nicegames.club/discord and say hello. So, until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
All right, Ellen, we're moving from your topic to Steven's. We're going to need that transition from you now.
Wait,
thank you.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price. This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax Live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
At Kroger Pharmacy, CARE is making it easy to get vaccinated. CARE is helping you stay protected from flu, COVID, and RSV. Seasonal vaccines are available 7 days a week with evening hours. CARE is giving you a shot at staying healthy this season. Walk in whenever is best and get multiple vaccines in one visit at your local Kroger Pharmacy. So come and get the protection you need while protecting those around you. Kroger Health, a world of care, is in store. Visit Kroger.com/vaccines for more. Restrictions and exclusions apply. See site for details.